Right now, I'd like to welcome Nina Jablonski. She's a biological anthropologist, professor of anthropology at Pennsylvania State University, and author of Skin, a Natural History, published by the University of California Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So, who knew that there could be a natural history of skin? It's such an interesting topic in the first place.
Well, you know, we all have skin. We all use it. We all love our skin. But we don't really think about it very much. And one of the things
ladies of a certain age, maybe.
But ladies of a certain age think about their wrinkles. They think about sun damage. But we all need to think about how our skin came to be. And I wrote the book that I did about skin because I realized that although dermatologists and doctors think about skin, ladies of a certain age think about skin, that we all needed to think about our skin and how it evolved, its particular properties, especially its skin color.
So let's talk about the three features of human skin that make it unique in the animal kingdom.
Well, skin, human skin, is remarkable for these three reasons. Firstly, it's mostly naked. Apart from a few patches of hair that we have on our heads and a few other parts of our body, we're functionally naked. And we're very sweaty. So that's the first thing, that we're basically naked and extremely sweaty, and the sweat helps to keep us cool when we're exerting ourselves.
Now, what is the evolutionary adaptiveness of having so much less hair than our chimp and ape cousins?
Well, basically it comes down to the fact that being without hair helps you lose heat through sweating more effectively. And so as we lost our hair, we increased the number of sweat glands on the surface of our skin, and that made us very much better at cooling our bodies during times of exertion or when the environment's really hot. So having less hair in a hot place, especially if you're really active, is very important.
Why is the male half of the species so much hairier than the female?
Well, in some populations of humans, that is true. But in many populations, both sexes are equally hairless. So we generally associate hairiness with European men, or men of European ancestry.
Who are closer to their chimp relatives?
That may be your opinion.
But
we don't really know why European males have so much hair, but the rule for most of the species is functional hairlessness in both sexes.
Interesting. So you start off the book talking about the fact that the skin is an organ, which is something I remember learning in biology class way back when, but most people don't think of it that way.
Well, the skin is an organ because it does so much stuff. It has multiple layers in it, and in these layers, it has different kinds of glands. It has sweat glands. It has cells from the immune system. It has pigment-producing cells. It has hair follicles. I mean, it's this complex bunch of different kinds of biological tissues all working together. And what the skin does is basically help maintain our body's homeostasis. It helps keep us cool. It protects us from outside influences like excess amounts of water or chemicals or bacteria. I mean, it's this incredibly versatile covering. Also, it comes in a range of colors, and that's the second unique aspect of skin that I wanted to point out, because this natural range of colors isn't at all arbitrary. It evolved in the course of our species evolution, and that's one of the most exciting things about us, is that we come in this range of colors from almost near ebony, very, very dark brown, to near ivory, very, very pale, almost white. And those colors are very much related to the levels of ultraviolet radiation that our ancestors experienced.
And the third thing is that we humans decorate ourselves.
Yes, we love to do all sorts of things to our skin to make statements about who we are. you know, during your own lifetime and during the lifetimes of your parents, the styles of decoration have changed. We've gone from having different kinds of cosmetics to sort of extreme tattoos to body paints to different kinds of piercings. And through the ages, people have come to express themselves in various ways through the decorations they place upon their skin. Some of them are just temporary, some of them are permanent, but they say a lot about us in terms of our of what we aspire to be, the groups that we affiliate ourselves with, and how we want people to view us.
We're talking to Nina Jablonski. Let's go back to the question of skin color. How did the variation in skin color evolve, and what color were the first tribes of human beings running around Africa?
Well, the
And how do we even know? Because, I mean, the fossil record isn't going to contain that.
That's right. We make a lot of the inferences about the evolution of skin by looking at comparative anatomical evidence as well as molecular and genetic evidence. So we don't have actually fossilized skin in different colors. We use indirect kinds of evidence to make these inferences. But one of the things that we know for certain is that humans evolved in the tropics under very high ultraviolet radiation conditions. And so they really needed to protect their skin against the harmful effects of ultraviolet radiation. Now, in nature, we have this marvelous set of compounds called melanins, which are very stable, natural pigments. And the most common type of melanin is extremely dark. And that pigment is used by a variety of different animals and to great advantage, because melanin absorbs and scatters ultraviolet radiation. And so in many animals who have evolved in the tropics or in under other high UV regimes, they've evolved a lot of melanin in their skin or their protective coverings. And so what did humans do in the course of their evolution? Just the same thing. We evolved new genetic variations that led to us having high levels of melanin in the skin of our equatorial ancestors.
So the more melanin, the darker you are.
The more melanin, the darker you are, the better you're prepared against the deleterious effects of high UV in the sunlight. All of our ancestors for our lineage of modern humans were darkly pigmented. They lived in the tropics, and they then dispersed outside of the tropics to other parts of the world in the last 130,000 or so years. And that's where different colors of skin, different shades of skin evolved, because as soon as you move outside of the tropics and UV isn't so intense, then you have to actually lose pigment in the skin.
Why?
Because your skin is a really complex organ, as we mentioned. And one of the things that it does is it actually serves as a vitamin D factory. You produce vitamin D in your skin. Now, if you live at the equator and you've got dark skin, you can produce a lot of vitamin D just because the intensity of the UV is so high. UV radiation interacts with the skin to produce vitamin D. But if you live outside of tropical areas, the wavelengths of ultraviolet radiation that actually produce vitamin D are much fewer. They form a lesser percentage of the sunshine. And so it's harder for people who live at, even at the latitude of Santa Fe, or certainly at the latitude of New York City or Nova Scotia, to produce vitamin D in their skin from the level of ultraviolet that they get in the sun. So the long and short of it is, people actually had to become lighter as they moved and lived for long periods of time outside of tropical latitudes.
So Northern Europeans are going to be lighter than Southern Europeans, who are going to be lighter than people from the tropics.
That's right. And the lightness of the skin facilitates the penetration of ultraviolet radiation in the skin and the production of vitamin D.
So if you are a black person and you move to Sweden, you better take vitamin D supplements.
That's right. And this is one of the things that we've realized is that in the last 500 years, and especially just in the last 100 years, people have moved around dramatically with great rapidity, so that folks from equatorial Africa can now live in Sweden. People from Sweden can go live in equatorial Africa. And they both have to take into account the fact that their skin isn't inherently well adapted to those environments.
And so they have to bring sunscreen or vitamins. And do most people know this?
No. I mean, we, as light-skinned people, many of us know about the problems of being in the sun, because so many doctors tell us about the risk of skin cancer. But we don't know about so many of the other damaging effects of excess amounts of sun. This can affect people with lightly pigmented skin, because you can get a lot more than just skin cancer from too much sun. But one of the great and poorly recognized problems of darkly pigmented people is that when they do move to a northerly place, or if they simply have a desk job and sit inside all the time, that they won't get enough sun to make vitamin D. And so they need to take vitamin supplements so that they make sure that their vitamin D concentrations are up to par.
We're talking to Nina Jablonski. So let's move on to the whole topic of decoration. What are the various ways that people decorate their skin, and what are their reasons for doing it?
Well, people decorate their skin for a variety of reasons. And some people prefer to only wear, you know, the lightest amount of temporary decoration. They might put body paint on for a particular ceremony. They might put a little extra blusher on their skin to look a little, what they would call, healthier or fresher at various times of the day. But other people put permanent marks on their skin, usually for more serious reasons. So we see both temporary and permanent kinds of body markings. And generally, the temporary ones are for single occasions or for making people look good for a short period of time, let's say for an initiation ritual, or so that you look good in a particular photograph. But if you decide to do something permanent, you're making a much different kind of statement. People who have pierced ears or multiple facial piercings or body piercings, or people who undertake tattooing, a little tattoo or multiple tattoos, they're making a real statement about how they want the world to see them, about the group that they associate with. Or in many cases, when people get a large series of tattoos, they're really trying to tell people in a very immediate way, these things that I've put on my skin are important to me. These pictures relate to my history, to my heritage, to my life, and I want you to know them. So people decorate themselves for a wide variety of reasons, and it's absolutely fascinating.
Well, there's one group that you told me that you wrote about that the women get tattoos all over their faces so that the men of other places don't take their women away.
Yes, and there are some groups, especially in East and Southeast Asia, in which women receive these facial tattoos at the time they go through puberty so that they become marked as members of that group. Men within their group think that these tattoos, these beautiful geometric designs on their faces, are very beautiful. But men outside of their group think that they're ugly and
right,
that they look like they have a crossword puzzle on their face. So this is something that helps to maintain the women within their group so that they don't leave.
I often wondered, there was a period, I don't know whether it was 10 or 15 years ago, where a lot of young people, Americans, started getting tattoos in numbers that their corresponding people, 10, 20 years earlier had not gotten at all. And I wondered whether, getting something that permanent when you're that young was kind of a statement that you thought, well, the world is going to end anyway. Who cares if something's permanent, because our lives are not our days are numbered anyhow.
I think that's certainly part of it. And I also think that it had to do with the fact that lots of celebrities were getting tattoos, and young people very much want to be accepted by their peer group. And so if having a tattoo like a particular celebrity helps you become more accepted in your group, then you're going to get it. And it doesn't matter if your parents say, or if some of your friends say, well, you might not like that in 5 years. who cares? You know, you want to get it now because you want to look cool. And so I think there's a big element of sort of looking cool almost at any cost.
You have a chapter in the book on touch and the importance of skin touching skin, you know, one person's skin touching another person's skin. And I wondered, what is the electrochemical phenomenon that's going on with touch?
Well, in our skin, we not only have all of these different glands that I was telling you about, but we also have a variety of different sensory receptors that are extremely good at detecting temperature and various depths of touch, light touch, deep touch. And basically what goes on is when we touch something, those touch receptors send particular kinds of signals back to the brain indicating the kind of touch that's going on. So these are special kinds of neurons, special kinds of nerve cells that conduct particular kinds of information. And we are endowed as primates with a lot of these specialized touch receptors, specifically on our hands and our faces. So the density of these is very high, and we can discriminate tremendous amounts of detail about any surface that we're touching or about another person from these different receptors in our fingers and a face.
And so what is the adaptive purpose of having so much in your fingers and your face? I mean, is it just knowing your environment in terms of the hands and then being careful of any kind of invasion of your body?
That's certainly part of it, but it's also being able to tell a lot about the texture of food that you might eat. Is this fruit really good to eat? You can discriminate very fine levels of ripeness just by touching a piece of fruit. You can also touch a person and immediately feel if they're running a temperature, if they're cold and clammy. We get a huge amount of information about other humans just from touching them. So basically, in addition to our eyes, our fingers are these huge information gathering instruments about our environment.
Now, you talk about societies that are I can't remember what you call it, some societies are full of people who touch each other a lot and then others don't. And
yes.
Some people carry their babies and other than put them in strollers.
Yes.
And so on. What's the difference between those two?
Well, I like to talk about touch averse and touchy kinds of societies.
Right.
And what's interesting is that now in the United States, you have a real battleground between touch-averse and touchy people. In most of the workplaces in which we operate, we are not allowed to touch one another. And yet, inherently, we want to. We want to be able to touch people, and not necessarily in sort of lascivious ways or inappropriate ways. We want to be able to comfort one another or touch one another at natural times. So the United States, in the last 20 years, has become a legislated touch-averse society outside of the home. And that's quite unfortunate because we benefit physically from touch. We evolved to touch one another. And when societies, either through legislation or through practice, when people stop touching one another, it actually leads to much higher levels of anxiety and stress, because touching helps to relieve anxiety and relieve long-term stress. It's quite remarkable in its property. So that's the United States. But there are countries that are very touchy. If you go to Europe, for instance, if you go to a typical Italian family gathering. My family background is half Italian, so when I go to an Italian family gathering or go to Italy, people are constantly touching and hugging one another. It's a normal part of human commerce, and they feel that it's an essential part of the family bond and bond with friends. If you go to England, it's one of the more touch-averse places, as are parts of Germany. There are various populations that are exceptions, but these countries are very touch-averse, and touch is formalized by just a handshake or very, very formal pecks on the cheek. And big hugs and, you know, lots of arm holding and so forth are really not part of normal human commerce.
Well, and I've traveled to places where it is absolutely normal for a 10 or 12 year old child to sleep in the bed with their parents or their cousins or even a guest. You know, I'm lying in bed and the 10 year old crawls in, and that's just considered the way it is. Partly because there's not enough beds, but partly because it's a, and I think it makes a huge difference in how people feel in their bodies and how they walk around in their lives.
It's something that in the United States, again, we have come to eschew this idea of bringing kids up in close physical proximity to their parents, although we're taught that we should keep infants very close to our bodies because that's important. As soon as an infant gets to be sort of 9 or 12 months old, we're told, oh, it's good for them to, you know, start sleeping in their own crib, and then they have their own room, and they should be physically separated so that they become more independent and tough. And this is really more American culture. It is not human nature. Our nature is to maintain close physical proximity throughout our lives. And although I have no special retrospectroscope to see the past, I can infer from the activities of our primate relatives and also from many indigenous groups in the world that people stay in close contact with one another throughout their life. Kids do tend to sleep with their parents for long periods of time, you know, into their early teens, even before they become mature adults themselves. And so we have evolved this touching, this proximity, and this helps to relieve stress in many social situations because touching does lower levels of stress hormones in the body. So the kind of behavior that we see in sort of normal American houses is quite abnormal for our species, even though we consider it to be, you know, really the only way to operate.
Nina Jablonski is a biological anthropologist. There's much more to talk about, but unfortunately it's time to go. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.